touched me as he never did any other woman. But was it me he loved? For he hated in me the things you hate. He was on your side all the time without knowing it. You willed our separation, but he willed it too. He worked for it with his anger and his jealousy, and he worked for it with his love. For he gave me so much love, and I gave him so much love, that soon there wasn't anything left when we'd finished but you, for either of us. I might have taken a lifetime, spending a little love at a time, eking it out here and there on this man and that. But even the first time, in the hotel near Paddington, we spent all we had. You were there, teaching us to squander like you taught the rich man, so that one day we might have nothing left except this love of you. But you are too good to me. When I ask you for pain, you give me peace. Give it him, too. Give him my peace. He needs it more. 12th of February, 1946. 2 days ago I had such a sense of peace and quiet and love. Life was going to be happy again. But last night I dreamed I was walking up a long staircase to meet Morris at the top. I was still happy because when I reached the top of the staircase we were going to make love. I called to him that I was coming, but it wasn't Morris's voice that answered. It was a stranger's that boomed like a foghorn, warning lost ships and scared me. I thought he's let his flat and gone away, and I don't know where he is, and going down the stairs again, the water rose beyond my waist, and the hall was thick with mist. Then I woke up. I'm not at peace any more. I just want him, like I used to in the old days. I want to be eating sandwiches with him, I want to be drinking with him in a bar. I'm tired, and I don't want any more pain. I want Morris. I want ordinary, corrupt, human love. Dear God, you know I want your pain, but I don't want it now. Take it away for a while and give it me another time. Book 4, Chapter 1. I couldn't read any more. Over and over again I had skipped when a passage hurt me too much. I had wanted to discover about Dunstan, though I hadn't wanted to discover that much, but now I had read on. It slipped far back in time like a dull date in history. It wasn't of present importance. The entry I was left with was an entry only 1 week old. I want Morris. I want ordinary, corrupt, human love. It's all I can give you, I thought. I don't know about any other kind of love, but if you think I've squandered all of that, you're wrong. There's enough left for our two lives, and I thought of that day when she had packed her suitcase and I sat working here, not knowing that happiness was so close. I was glad I hadn't known, and I was glad that I knew. I could act now. Dunstan didn't matter. The air raid warden didn't matter. I went to the telephone and dialed her number. The maid answered. I said, "This is Mr. Bendrix. I want to speak to Mrs. Miles." She told me to hold on. I felt breathless, as though I were at the end of a long race, as I waited for Sarah's voice, but the voice that came was the maid's, telling me that Mrs. Miles was out. I don't know why I didn't believe her. I waited 5 minutes, and then, with my handkerchief stretched tight over the mouthpiece, I rang again. "Is Mr. Miles in?" "No, sir." "Could I speak to Mrs. Miles, then? This is Sir William Mallock." There was only a very short pause before Sarah replied. "Good evening, this is Mrs. Miles." "I know," I said. "I know your voice, Sarah." "You?" "I thought..." "Sarah," I said, "I'm coming to see you." "No, please, no, listen, Morris, I'm in bed. I'm speaking from there now." "All the better." "Don't be a fool, Morris. I mean, I'm ill." "Then you'll have to see me." "What's the matter, Sarah?" "Oh, nothing. A bad cold. Listen, Morris..." She spaced her words slowly like a governess, and it angered me. "Please don't come. I can't see you."
"I love you, Sarah, and I'm coming."
"I won't be here. I'll get up." I thought, if I run, it will only take me 4 minutes across the common. She can't dress in that time. I'll tell the maid not to let anybody in. She's not got the build of a chucker out, and I'll have to be chucked out, Sarah. Please, Morris, I'm asking you. I haven't asked anything of you for a long time. Except one lunch. Morris, I'm not awfully fit. I just can't see you today. Next week, there have been a terrible lot of weeks. I want to see you now, this evening. Why, Morris? You love me. How do you know? Never mind. I want to ask you to come away with me. But, Morris, I can answer you on the phone just as well. The answer is no. I can't touch you by telephone, Sarah. Morris, my dear, please. Promise you won't come. I'm coming. Listen, Morris, I'm feeling awfully sick. The pain's bad tonight. I don't want to get up. You don't have to. I swear I'll get up and dress and leave the house unless you promise. This is more important to both of us, Sarah, than a cold. Please. Morris, please, Henry will be home soon. Let him be. I rang off. It was a worse night than the one when I met Henry a month before. This time it was sleet instead of rain. It was halfway to snow, and the edged drops seemed to slash their way in through the buttonholes of one's raincoat. They obscured the lamps on the common so that it was impossible to run, and I can't run fast anyway because of my leg. I wished I'd brought my wartime torch with me, for it must have taken 8 minutes for me to reach the house on the north side. I was just stepping off the pavement to cross when the door opened and Sarah came out. I thought with happiness, I have her now. I knew with absolute certainty that before the night was out, we should have slept together again. And once that had been renewed, anything might happen. I had never known her before, and I had never loved her so much. The more we know, the more we love, I thought. I was back in the territory of trust. She was in too much of a hurry to see me across the wide roadway through the sleet. She turned to the left and walked rapidly away. I thought she will need somewhere to sit down, and then I will have her trapped. I followed 20 yards behind, but she never looked back. She skirted the common, past the pond and the bombed bookshop as though she were making for the tube. Well, if it were necessary, I was prepared to talk to her even in a crowded train. She went down the tube stairs and up to the booking office, but she had no bag with her, and when she felt in her pockets, no loose money either. Not even the 3 halfpence it would have taken to enable her to travel up and down till midnight. Up the stairs again, and across the road where the trams run. One earth had been stopped, but another had obviously come to mind. I was triumphant. She was afraid, but she wasn't afraid of me. She was afraid of herself and what was going to happen when we met. I felt I had won the game already. And I could afford to feel a certain pity for my victim. I wanted to say to her, "Don't worry, there's nothing to fear. We'll both be happy soon. The nightmare's nearly over." And then I lost her. I had been too confident, and I had allowed her too big a start. She had crossed the road 20 yards ahead of me. I was delayed again by my bad leg coming up the stairs. A tram ran between, and she was gone. She might have turned left down the high street or gone straight ahead down Park Road, but I couldn't see her. I wasn't very worried. If I didn't find her today, I would the next. Now I knew the whole absurd story of the vow. Now I was certain of her love. I was assured of her. If two people loved, they slept together. It was a mathematical formula, tested and proved by human experience. There was an ABC in the high street, and I tried that. She wasn't there. Then I remembered the church at the corner of Park Road, and I knew at once that she had gone there. I followed, and sure enough, there she was, sitting in one of the side aisles, close to a pillar and a hideous statue of the Virgin. She wasn't praying. She was just sitting there with her eyes closed. I only saw her by the light of the candles before the statue, for the whole place was very dark. I sat down behind her, like Mr. Parkes, and waited. I could have waited years, now that I knew the end of the story. I was cold and wet and very happy. I could even look with charity towards the altar and the figure dangling there. She loves us both, I thought, but if there's to be a conflict between an image and a man, I know who will win. I could put my hand on her thigh or my mouth on her breast. He was imprisoned behind the altar and couldn't move to plead his cause. Suddenly she began to cough with her hand pressed to her side. I knew she was in pain, and I couldn't leave her alone in pain. I came and sat beside her and put my hand on her knee while she coughed. I thought, if only one had a touch that could heal. When the fit was over, she said, "Please, won't you let me be?" "I'll never let you be," I said. "What's come over you, Morris? You weren't like that the other day at lunch." "I was bitter. I didn't know you loved me." "Why do you think I do?" she asked. But she let my hand rest on her knee. I told her then how Mr. Parkes had stolen her diary. I didn't want any lies between us now. "It wasn't a good thing to do," she said.
"No."
She began to cough again, and afterwards, in her exhaustion, she leant her shoulder against me. "My dear," I said, "it's all over now. The waiting, I mean. We're going away together." "No," she said. I put my arm around her and touched her breast. "This is where we begin again," I said. "I've been a bad lover, Sarah. It was the insecurity that did it. I didn't trust you. I didn't know enough about you. But I'm secure now." She said nothing, but she still leant against me. It was like an assent. I said, "I'll tell you how it had better be. Go back home and lie in bed for a couple of days. You don't want to travel with a cold like that. I'll ring up every day and see how you are. When you are well enough, I'll come over and help you pack. We won't stay here. I have a cousin in Dorset who has an empty cottage I can use. We'll stay there a few weeks and rest. I'll be able to finish my book. We can face the lawyers afterwards. We need a rest, both of us. I'm tired, and I'm sick to death of being without you, Sarah." "Me too." She spoke so low that I wouldn't have heard the phrase if I'd been a stranger to it. But it was like a signature tune that echoed through all our relationship from the first lovemaking in the Paddington Hotel. "Me too, for loneliness, griefs, disappointments, pleasures, and despairs, the claim to share everything." "Money's going to be short," I said, "but not too short. I've been commissioned to do a life of General Gordon, and the advance is enough to keep us for 3 months comfortably. By that time I can hand in the novel and get an advance on that. Both books will be out this year, and they should keep us till another's ready. I can work with you there. You know, any moment now I'm going to come through. I'll be a vulgar success yet, and you'll hate it, and I'll hate it, and we'll buy things and be extravagant, and it will be fun because we'll be together." Suddenly I realized she was asleep. Exhausted by her flight, she had fallen asleep against my shoulder, as so many times in taxis, in buses, on a park seat. I sat still and let her be. There was nothing to disturb her in the dark church. The candles flapped around the Virgin, and there was nobody else there. The slowly growing pain in my upper arm where her weight lay was the greatest pleasure I had ever known. Children are supposed to be influenced by what you whisper to them in sleep, and I began to whisper to Sarah, not loud enough to wake her, hoping that the words would drop hypnotically into her unconscious mind. "I love you, Sarah," I whispered. "Nobody has ever loved you as much before. We are going to be happy. Henry won't mind except in his pride, and pride soon heals. He'll find himself a new habit to take your place. Perhaps you'll collect Greek coins. We are going away, Sarah. We are going away. Nobody can stop it now. You love me, Sarah." And I fell silent as I began to wonder whether I ought to buy a new suitcase. Then she woke, coughing. "I've been asleep," she said. "You must go home now, Sarah. You're cold." "It isn't home, Morris," she said. "I don't want to go away from here. It's cold. I don't mind the cold. And it's dark. I can believe anything in the dark. Just believe in us." "That's what I meant." She shut her eyes again, and looking up at the altar, I thought with triumph, almost as though he were a living rival, "You see, These are the arguments that win. And gently moved my fingers across her breast. You're tired, aren't you? I asked. Very tired. You shouldn't have run away from me like that. It wasn't you I was running from. She moved her shoulder. Please, Morris, go now. You ought to be in bed. I will be soon. I don't want to go back with you. I just want to say goodbye here. Promise you won't stay long? I promise. And you'll telephone to me? She nodded, but looking down at her hand where it lay in her lap like something thrown away, I saw that she had her fingers crossed. I asked her with suspicion, "You are telling me the truth." I uncrossed her fingers with mine and said, "You aren't planning to escape me again." "Morris, dear Morris," she said, "I haven't got the strength." She began to cry, thrusting her fists into her eyes as a child does. "I'm sorry," she said, "just go away, please. Morris, have a bit of mercy." One gets to the end of badgering and contriving. I couldn't go on with that appeal in my ears. I kissed her on the tough and knotty hair, and coming away I found her lips smudgy and salt on the corner of my mouth. "God bless you," she said, and I thought, that's what she crossed out in her letter to Henry. One says goodbye to another's goodbye, unless one is smythe, and it was an involuntary act when I repeated her blessing back to her, but turning as I left the church and seeing her huddled there at the edge of the candlelight like a beggar come in for warmth, I could imagine a God blessing her, or a God loving her. When I began to write our story down, I thought I was writing a record of hate. But somehow the hate has got mislaid, and all I know is that in spite of her mistakes and her unreliability, she was better than most. It's just as well that one of us should believe in her. She never did in herself. Chapter 2. The next few days I had to make a great effort to be sensible. I was working for both of us now. In the morning I set myself a minimum of 750 words on the novel, but usually I managed to get 1,000 done by 11 o'clock. It's astonishing, the effect of hope. The novel that had dragged all through the last year ran towards its end. I knew that Henry left for work around 9:30, and the most likely hour for her to telephone was between then and 12:30. Henry had started coming home for lunch, so Parkes had told me. There was no chance of her telephoning again before 3. I would revise my day's work and do my letters until 12:30, and then I was released, however gloomily, from expectation. Until 2:30 I could put in time at the British Museum reading room, making notes for the life of General Gordon. I couldn't absorb myself in reading and note-taking as I could in writing the novel. And the thought of Sarah came between me and the missionary life in China. Why had I been invited to write this biography, I often wondered. They would have done better to have chosen an author who believed in Gordon's God. I could appreciate the obstinate stand at Khartoum, the hatred of the safe politicians at home. But the Bible on the desk belonged to another world of thought from mine. Perhaps the publisher half hoped that my cynical treatment of Gordon's Christianity would cause a succès de scandale. I had no intention of pleasing him. This God was also Sarah's God, and I was going to throw no stones at any phantom she believed she loved. I hadn't, during that period, any hatred of her God, for hadn't I, in the end, proved stronger? One day, as I ate my sandwiches, onto which my indelible pencil somehow always got transferred, a familiar voice greeted me from the desk opposite in a tone hushed out of respect for our fellow workers. "I hope all goes well now, sir, if you'll forgive the personal intrusion." I looked over the back of my desk at the unforgettable moustache. "Very well, Parkes, thank you. Have an illicit sandwich?" "I don't know, sir. I couldn't possibly. Come on now, imagine it's on expenses." Reluctantly, He took one and, opening it up, remarked with a kind of horror, as though he had accepted a coin and found it gold, "It's real ham. My publisher sent me a tin from America." "It's too good of you, sir." "I still have your ashtray, Parkes," I whispered because my neighbour had looked angrily up at me. "It's of sentimental value only," he whispered back. "How's your boy?" "A little bilious, sir." "I'm surprised to find you here. Work? You aren't watching one of us, surely?" I couldn't imagine that any of the dusty inmates of the reading room, the men who wore hats and scarves indoors for warmth, the Indian who was painfully studying the complete works of George Eliot, or the man who slept every day with his head laid beside the same pile of books, could be concerned in any drama of sexual jealousy. "Oh, no, sir. This isn't work. It's my day off. And the boy's back at school today." "What are you reading?" "The Times Law Reports, sir. Today I'm on the Russell case." "They give a kind of background to one's work, sir. Open up vistas. They take one away from the daily petty detail. I knew one of the witnesses in this case, sir. We were in the same office once. Well, he's gone down to history as I never shall now."
"Oh, you never know, Parkes?"
"One does know, sir. That's the discouraging thing. The Bolton case was as far as I'll ever get. The law that forbade the evidence in divorce cases being published was a blow to men of my calling. The judge, sir, never mentions us by name, and he's very often prejudiced against the profession. It had never struck me," I said with sympathy. Even Parkes could awake a longing. I could never see him without the thought of Sarah. I went home in the tube with the hope for company, and sitting at home, in dying expectation of the telephone bell ringing, I saw my companion depart again. It wouldn't be today. At 5 o'clock I dialed the number, but as soon as I heard the ringing tone, I replaced the receiver. Perhaps Henry was back early, and I couldn't speak to Henry now, for I was the victor, since Sarah loved me, and Sarah wanted to leave him. But a delayed victory constrained the nerves as much as a prolonged defeat. 8 days passed before the telephone rang. It wasn't the time of day I expected, for it was before 9 o'clock in the morning. And when I said, "Hello," it was Henry who answered. "Is that Bendrix?" he asked. There was something very queer about his voice, and I wondered, has she told him? "Yes, speaking. An awful thing's happened. You ought to know. Sarah's dead." How conventionally we behave at such moments. I said, "I'm terribly sorry, Henry. Are you doing anything tonight?" "No. I wish you'd come over for a drink. I don't fancy being alone."
Book 5, Chapter 1.
I stayed the night with Henry. It was the first time I had slept in Henry's house. They had only one guest room, and Sarah was there. She had moved into it a week before so as not to disturb Henry with her cough, so I slept on the sofa in the drawing room where we had made love. I didn't want to stay the night, but he begged me to. We must have drunk a bottle and a half of whiskey between us. I remember Henry saying, "It's strange, Bendrix, how one can't be jealous about the dead. She's only been dead a few hours, and yet I wanted you with me. You hadn't so much to be jealous about. It was all over a long time ago. I don't need that kind of comfort now, Bendrix. It was never over with either of you. I was the lucky man. I had her all those years. Do you hate me?" "I don't know, Henry. I thought I did, but I don't know." We sat in his study with no light on. The gas fire was not turned high enough to see each other's faces, so that I could only tell when Henry wept by the tone of his voice. The discus thrower aimed at both of us from the darkness. "Tell me how it happened, Henry,"
You remember that night I met you on the common? 3 weeks ago, or four, was it? She got a bad cold that night. She wouldn't do anything about it. I never even knew it had reached her chest. She never told anybody those sort of things. And not even her diary, I thought. There had been no word of sickness there. She hadn't the time to be ill. She took to her bed in the end, Henry said. But nobody could have kept her there. She wouldn't have a doctor. She never believed in them. She got up and went out a week ago. God knows where or why. She said she needed exercise. I came home first and found her gone. She didn't get in till 9, soaked through, worse than the first time. She must have been walking about for hours in the rain. She was feverish all night, talking to somebody, I don't know who. It wasn't you or me, Bendrix. I made her see a doctor after that. He said if she'd had penicillin a week earlier, he'd have saved her. There wasn't anything to do for either of us but pour out more whiskey. I thought of the stranger I had paid Parkes to track down. The stranger had certainly won in the end. No, I thought, I don't hate Henry. I hate you, if you exist. I remembered what she'd said to Richard Smythe, that I had taught her to believe. I couldn't for the life of me tell how, but to think of what I had thrown away made me hate myself, too. Henry said, she died at 4 this morning. I wasn't there. The nurse didn't call me in time. Where's the nurse? She finished her job off very tidily. She had another urgent case and left before lunch. I wish I could be of use to you. You are, just sitting here. It's been an awful day, Bendrix. You know, I've never had a death to deal with. I always assumed I'd die first, and Sarah would have known what to do. If she'd stayed with me that long. In a way, it's a woman's job, like having a baby. I suppose the doctor helped. He's awfully rushed this winter. He rang up an undertaker. I wouldn't have known where to go. We've never had a trade directory. But a doctor can't tell me what to do with her clothes. The cupboards are full of them. Compacts, scents. One can't just throw things away. If only she had a sister. He suddenly stopped because the front door opened and closed just as it had on that other night when he had said, "The maid," and I had said, "It's Sarah." We listened to the footsteps of the maid going upstairs. It's extraordinary how empty a house can be with three people in it. We drank our whiskey and I poured another. "I've got plenty in the house," Henry said. "Sarah found a new source," and stopped again. She stood at the end of every path. There wasn't any point in trying to avoid her even for a moment. I thought, why did you have to do this to us? If she hadn't believed in you, she would be alive now. We should have been lovers still. It was sad and strange to remember that I had been dissatisfied with the situation. I would have shared her now happily with Henry. I said, "And the funeral?" "Bendrix, I don't know what to do." Something very puzzling happened. When she was delirious, of course she wasn't responsible, the nurse told me that she kept on asking for a priest. At least she kept on saying, "Father, Father," and it couldn't have been her own. She never knew him. Of course the nurse knew we weren't Catholics. She was quite sensible. She soothed her down. "But I'm worried, Bendrix." I thought with anger and bitterness, "You might have left poor Henry alone. We have got on for years without you. Why should you suddenly start intruding into all situations like a strange relation returned from the Antipodes?" Henry said, "If one lives in London, cremation's the easiest thing." Until the nurse said that to me, I'd been planning to have it done at Golders Green. The undertaker rang up the crematorium. They can fit Sarah in the day after tomorrow. "She was delirious," I said. "You don't have to take what she said into account." I wondered whether I ought to ask a priest about it. She kept so many things quiet. For all I know, she may have become a Catholic. She's been so strange lately. Oh, no, Henry. She didn't believe in anything any more than you or me. I wanted her burnt up. I wanted to be able to say, resurrect that body if you can. My jealousy had not finished, like Henry's, with her death. It was as if she were alive still in the company of a lover she had preferred to me. How I wished I could send Parkis after her to interrupt their eternity. You are quite certain?
Quite certain, Henry. I thought, I've got to be careful. I mustn't be like Richard Smythe. I mustn't hate, for if I were really to hate, I would believe, and if I were to believe, what a triumph for you and her. This is to play act. Talking about revenge and jealousy, it's just something to fill the brain with so that I can forget the absoluteness of her death. A week ago, I had only to say to her, do you remember that first time together and how I hadn't got a shilling for the meter? And the scene would be there for both of us. Now it was there for me only. She had lost all our memories forever, and it was as though by dying she had robbed me of part of myself. I was losing my individuality. It was the first stage of my own death, the memories dropping off like gangrened limbs. I hate all this fuss of prayers and gravediggers, but if Sarah wanted it, I'd try and get it arranged. She chose her wedding in a registry office, I said. She wouldn't want her funeral to be in a church. No, I suppose that's true, isn't it? Registration and cremation, I said. They go together. And in the shadow, Henry lifted his head and peered towards me as though he suspected my irony. Let me take it all out of your hands, I suggested. Just as in the same room, by the same fire, I had suggested visiting Mr. Savage for him. It's good of you, Bendrix. He drained the last of the whiskey into our glasses very carefully and evenly. Midnight, I said. You must get some sleep, if you can. The doctor left me some pills. But he didn't want to be alone yet. I knew exactly how he felt, for I, too, after a day with Sarah, would postpone for as long as I could the loneliness of my room. I keep on forgetting she's dead, Henry said. And I had experienced that, too, all through 1945, the bad year. Forgetting when I woke that our love affair was over, that the telephone might carry any voice except hers. She had been as dead then as she was dead now. For a month or two, this year, a ghost had pained me with hope. But the ghost was laid and the pain would be over soon. I would die, a little more every day. But how I longed to retain it. As long as one suffers, one lives. Go to bed, Henry. I'm afraid of dreaming about her. You won't, if you take the doctor's pills. Would you like one, Bendrix?
No.
You wouldn't, would you, stay the night? It's filthy outside. I don't mind the weather. You'd be doing me a great favour. Of course I'll stay. I'll bring down some sheets and blankets.
Don't bother, Henry.
But he was gone. I looked at the parquet floor, and I remembered the exact timbre of her cry. On the desk where she wrote her letters was a clutter of objects, and every object I could interpret like a code. I thought, she hasn't even thrown away that pebble. We laughed at its shape, and there it still is, like a paperweight. What would Henry make of it, and the miniature bottle of a liqueur none of us cared for, and the piece of glass polished by the sea, and the small wooden rabbit I had found in Nottingham? Should I take all these objects away with me? They would go into the waste-paper basket, otherwise, when Henry at last got around to clearing up, but could I bear their company? I was looking at them when Henry came in, burdened with blankets. I had forgotten to say, Bendrix, if there's anything you want to take. I don't think she's left a will.
It's kind of you.
I'm grateful now to anybody who loved her.
I'll take this stone, if I may.
She kept the oddest things. I've brought you a pair of my pajamas, Bendrix.
Henry had forgotten to bring a pillow, and lying with my head on a cushion, I imagined I could smell her scent. I wanted things I should never have again. There was no substitute. I couldn't sleep. I pressed my nails into my palms, as she had done with hers, so that the pain might prevent my brain working, and the pendulum of my desire swung tiringly to and fro, and the desire to forget, and the desire to remember, to be dead and to keep alive, a while longer. And then at last I slept. I was walking up Oxford Street, and I was worried because I had to buy a present, and all the shops were full of cheap jewellery glittering under the concealed lighting. Now and then I thought I saw something beautiful, and I would approach the glass, but when I saw the jewel close, it would be as factitious as all the others, perhaps a hideous green bird with scarlet eyes meant to give the effect of rubies. Time was short, and I hurried from shop to shop. Then, out of one of the shops, came Sarah, and I knew that she would help me. "Have you bought something, Sarah?" "Not here," she said, "but they have some lovely little bottles further on."
"I haven't time," I begged her. "Help me. I've got to find something, for tomorrow's the birthday."
"Don't worry," she said. "Something always turns up. Don't worry." And suddenly I didn't worry. Oxford Street extended its boundaries into a great grey, misty field. My feet were bare, and I was walking in the dew alone and stumbling in a shallow rut. I woke, still hearing, "Don't worry," like a whisper lodged in the ear, a summer sound belonging to childhood. At breakfast time, Henry was still asleep, and the maid, whom Parkes had suborned, brought coffee and toast into me on a tray. She drew the curtains, and the sleet had changed blindingly to snow. I was still bleary with sleep and the contentment of my dream, and I was surprised to see her eyes red with old tears. "Is anything the matter, Maud?" I asked. And it was only when she put the tray down and walked furiously out that I came properly awake to the empty house and the empty world. I went up and looked in at Henry. He was still in the depths of drugged sleep, smiling like a dog, and I envied him. Then I went down and tried to eat my toast. A bell rang, and I heard the maid leading somebody upstairs, the undertaker, I supposed, because I could hear the door of the guest room open. He was seeing her dead. I had not, but I had no wish to any more than I would have wished to see her in another man's arms. Some men may be stimulated that way, I am not. Nobody was going to make me pimp for death. I drew my mind together, and I thought, now that everything is really over, I have got to begin again. I have fallen in love once, it can be done again. But I was unconvinced. It seemed to me that I had given all the sex I had away. Another bell. What a lot of business was going on in the house while Henry slept. This time Maud came to me. She said, "There's a gentleman below asking for Mr. Miles, but I don't like to wake him."
"Who is he?"
"He's that friend of Mrs. Miles," she said, and for the only time admitted her share in our shabby collaboration.
"You'd better show him up," I said. I felt very superior to Smythe now, sitting in Sarah's drawing-room wearing Henry's pyjamas, knowing so much about him while he knew nothing about me. He looked at me with confusion and dripped snow onto the parquet. I said, "We met once. I'm a friend of Mrs. Miles."
"You had a small boy with you?"
"That's right."
"I came to see Mr. Miles," he said.
"You've heard the news?"
"That's why I came." "He's asleep. The doctor gave him pills." "It's been a bad shock to all of us," I added foolishly. He was staring round the room. In Cedar Road, coming out of nowhere, she had been as dimensionless, I suppose, as a dream. But this room gave her thickness. It was Sarah, too. The snow mounted slowly on the sill like mould from a spade. The room was being buried, like Sarah. He said, "I'll come back," and turned drearily away so that his bad cheek was turned on me. I thought. That was where her lips rested. She could always be snared by pity. He repeated stupidly, I came to see Mr. Miles and say how sorry.
It's more usual on these occasions to write.
I thought I might be of some use, he said weakly.
You don't have to convert Mr. Miles.
Convert?
He asked, ill at ease and bewildered.
To the fact that there's nothing left of her, the end. Annihilation. He broke suddenly out. I wanted to see her, that's all.
Mr. Miles doesn't even know you exist. It's not very considerate of you, Smythe, to come here.
When is the funeral?
Tomorrow at Golders Green.
She wouldn't have wanted that, he said, and took me by surprise.
She didn't believe in anything any more than you claim you do.
He said, don't any of you know? She was becoming a Catholic.
Nonsense.
She wrote to me. She made up her mind. Nothing I could have said would have done any good. She was beginning instruction, isn't that the word they use?
So she still had secrets, I thought. She had never put that in her journal any more than she had put her sickness. How much more was there to discover?
The thought was like despair.
That was a shock for you, wasn't it? I jeered at him, trying to transfer my pain.
Oh, I was angry, of course, but we can't all believe the same things.
That's not what you used to claim.
He looked at me as though he were puzzled by my enmity. He said, is your name Morris, by any chance?
It is.
She told me about you.
And I read about you. She made fools of us both.
I was unreasonable. He said, don't you think I could see her?
And I heard the heavy boots of the undertaker coming down, and I heard the same stair creak. She's lying upstairs, first door on the left.
If Mr. Miles... You won't wake him.
I had put on my clothes by the time he came down again. He said, thank you.
Don't thank me. I don't own her any more than you do. I've got no right to ask, he said, but I wish you'd... You loved her, I know.
He added, as though he were swallowing a bitter medicine,
she loved you.
What are you trying to say?
I wish you'd do something for her.
For her?
Let her have her Catholic funeral. She would have liked it.
What earthly difference does it make?
I don't suppose any for her, but it always pays us to be generous.
And what have I to do with it?
She always said that her husband had a great respect for you.
He was turning the screw of absurdity too far. I wished to shatter the deadness of this buried room with laughter. I sat down on the sofa and began to shake with it. I thought of Sarah dead upstairs and Henry asleep with a silly smile on his face and the lover with the spots discussing the funeral with the lover who had employed Mr. Parkes to sprinkle his doorbell with powder. The tears ran down my cheeks as I laughed. Once, in the Blitz, I saw a man laughing outside his house where his wife and child were buried.
I don't understand,
Smythe said. He held his right fist closed as though he were prepared to defend himself.
There was so much that neither of us understood. Pain was like an inexplicable explosion throwing us together.
I'll be going, he said, and reached for the doorknob with his left hand.
A strange idea occurred to me, because I had no reason to believe he was left-handed.
You must forgive me, I said.
I'm rattled. We're all rattled. I held out my hand to him. He hesitated and touched it with his left.
Smythe, I said, what have you got there? Did you take anything from her room?
He opened his hand and showed a scrap of hair.
That's all, he said. You hadn't any right.
Oh, she doesn't belong to anybody now, he said.
And suddenly I saw her for what she was. A piece of refuse, waiting to be cleared away. If you needed a bit of hair, you could take it, or trim her nails, if nail trimmings had value to you. Like a saint's, her bones could be divided up if anybody required them. She was going to be burnt soon, so why shouldn't everybody have what he wanted first? What a fool I had been during 3 years to imagine that in any way I had possessed her. We are possessed by nobody, not even by ourselves. "I'm sorry," I said. "Do you know what she wrote to me?" Smythe asked. "It was only 4 days ago, and I thought with sadness that she had had time to write to him, but not to telephone to me. She wrote, 'Pray for me.' Doesn't it seem odd asking me to pray for her?"
"What did you do?"
"Oh," he said, "when I heard she was dead, I prayed."
"Did you know any prayers?"
"No."
"It doesn't seem right, praying to a god you don't believe in." I followed him out of the house. There was no point in remaining till Henry woke. Sooner or later he had to face being on his own, just as I had. I watched Smythe jerking his way across the common ahead of me, and I thought, an hysterical type. Disbelief could be a product of hysteria just as much as belief. The wet of the snow, where the passage of many people had melted it, worked through my soles and reminded me of the dew of my dream. But when I tried to remember her voice, saying, "Don't worry," I found I had no memory for sounds. I couldn't imitate her voice. I couldn't even caricature it. When I tried to remember it, it was anonymous, just any woman's voice. The process of forgetting her had set in. We should keep gramophone records as we keep photographs. I came up the broken steps into the hall. Nothing but the stained glass was the same as that night in 1944. Nobody knows the beginning of anything. Sarah had really believed that the end began when she saw my body. She would never have admitted that the end had started long before. The fewer telephone calls for this or that inadequate reason, the quarrels I began with her because I had realized the danger of love ending. We had begun to look beyond love, but it was only I who was aware of the way we were being driven. If the bomb had fallen a year earlier, she wouldn't have made that promise. She would have torn her nails trying to release me. When we get to the end of human beings, we have to delude ourselves into a belief in God, like a gourmet who demands more complex sauces with his food. I looked at the hall, clear as a cell, hideous with green paint, and I thought, she wanted me to have a second chance. And here it is, the empty life, odorless, antiseptic. The life of a prison. And I accused her as though her prayers had really worked the change. What did I do to you that you had to condemn me to life? The stairs and banisters creaked with newness all the way upstairs. She had never walked up them. Even the repairs to the house were part of the process of forgetting. It needs a god outside time to remember when everything changes. Did I still love, or did I only regret love? I came into my room, and on the desk lay a letter from Sarah. She had been dead for 24 hours and unconscious for longer than that. How could a letter take so long across a strip of common? Then I saw that she had put my number wrong, and a little of the old bitterness seeped out. She wouldn't have forgotten my number 2 years ago. There was so much pain at the idea of seeing her writing that I nearly held the letter to the gas fire, but curiosity can be stronger than pain. It was written in pencil, I suppose, because she was writing in bed. "Dearest Morris," she wrote, "I meant to write to you the other night after you had gone away, but I felt rather sick when I got home and Henry fussed about me. I'm writing instead of telephoning. I can't telephone and hear your voice go queer when I say I'm not going to come away with you, because I'm not going to come away with you, Morris. Dearest Morris, I love you, but I can't see you again. I don't know how I'm going to live in this pain and longing, and I'm praying to God all the time that he won't be hard on me, that he won't keep me alive. Dear Morris, I want to have my cake and eat it, like everybody else. I went to a priest 2 days ago before you rang me up, and I told him I wanted to be a Catholic. I told him about my promise, and about you. I said, I'm not really married to Henry anymore. We don't sleep together, not since the first year with you. And it wasn't really a marriage, I said. You couldn't call a registry office a wedding. I asked him, couldn't I be a Catholic and marry you? I knew you wouldn't mind going through a service. Every time I asked him a question, I had such hope. It was like opening the shutters of a new house and looking for the view, and every window just faced a blank wall. No, 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 he said, I couldn't marry you. I couldn't go on seeing you, not if I was going to be a Catholic. I thought, to hell with the whole lot of them, and I walked out of the room where I was seeing him, and I slammed the door to show what I thought of priests. They are between us and God, I thought. God has more mercy. And then I came out of the church and saw the crucifix they have there. And I thought, of course, he's got mercy. Only it's such an odd sort of mercy. It sometimes looks like punishment. Morris, my dearest, I've got a foul headache and I feel like death. I wish I weren't as strong as a horse. I don't want to live without you. And I know one day I shall meet you on the common. And then I won't care a damn about Henry or God or anything. But what's the good, Morris? I believe there's a God. I believe the whole pack of tricks. There's nothing I don't believe. They could subdivide the Trinity into a dozen parts, and I'd believe. They could dig up records that proved that Christ had been invented by Pilate himself to get promoted, and I'd believe just the same. I've caught belief like a disease. I've fallen into belief like I fell in love. I've never loved before as I love you. And I've never believed in anything before as I believe now. I'm sure. I've never been sure before about anything. When you came in at the door with the blood on your face, I became sure. Once and for all. Even though I didn't know it at the time. I fought belief for longer than I fought love, but I haven't any fight left. Morris, dear, don't be angry. Be sorry for me, but don't be angry. I'm a phony and a fake, but this isn't phony or fake. I used to think I was sure about myself and what was right and wrong. And you taught me not to be sure. You took away all my lies and self-deceptions like they clear a road of rubble for somebody to come along, somebody of importance, and now he's come. But you cleared the way yourself. When you write, you try to be exact, and you taught me to want the truth, and you told me when I wasn't telling the truth. Do you really think that, you'd say, or do you only think you think it? So you see, it's all your fault, Morris. It's all your fault. I pray to God he won't keep me alive like this. There wasn't any more. She seemed to have had a knack of getting her prayers answered even before they were spoken, because hadn't she started dying that night when she came in out of the rain and found me with Henry? If I were writing a novel, I would end it here. A novel, I used to think, has to end somewhere, but I'm beginning to believe my realism has been at fault all these years, for nothing in life now ever seems to end. Chemists tell you matter is never completely destroyed, and mathematicians tell you that if you halve each pace in crossing a room, you will never reach the opposite wall. So what an optimist I would be if I thought that this story ended here. Only like Sarah, I wish I weren't as strong as a horse. Chapter 2. I was late for the funeral. I had gone into town to meet a man called Waterbury, who was going to write an article on my work in one of the little reviews. I tossed up whether to see him or not. I knew too well the pompous phrases of his article, the buried significance he would discover, of which I was unaware, and the faults I was tired of facing.
patronizingly, in the end he would place me probably a little above Morm, because Morm is popular and I have not yet committed that crime, not yet. But although I retain a little of the exclusiveness of unsuccess, the little reviews, like wise detectives, can scent it on its way. Why did I ever trouble to toss up? I didn't want to meet Waterbury, and certainly I didn't want to be written about. For I have come to an end of my interest in work now. No one can please me much with praise, or hurt me with blame. When I began that novel about the civil servant, I was still interested, but when Sarah left me, I recognized my work for what it was. As unimportant a drug as cigarettes to get one through the weeks and years. If we are extinguished by death, as I still try to believe, what point is there in leaving some books behind any more than bottles, clothes, or cheap jewelry? And if Sarah is right, how unimportant all the importance of art is. I tossed up, I think, simply from loneliness. I hadn't anything to do before the funeral. I wanted to fortify myself with a drink or two. One may cease to care about one's work, but one never ceases to care about conventions, and a man must not break down in public. Waterbury was waiting in a sherry bar off Tottenham Court Road. He wore black corduroy trousers and smoked cheap cigarettes. He had with him a girl, much taller and better looking than he was, who wore the same kind of trousers and smoked the same cigarettes. She was very young, and she was called Sylvia, and one knew that she was on a long course of study that had only begun with Waterbury. She was at the stage of imitating her teacher. I wondered where, with those looks, those alert, good-natured eyes and hair, the gold of illuminations, she would end. Would she even remember Waterbury in 10 years and the bar off Tottenham Court Road? I felt sorry for him. He was so proud now, so patronizing to both of us, but he was on the losing side. Why, I thought, catching her eye over my glass at a particularly fatuous comment of his about the stream of consciousness, even now I could get her from him. His articles were bound in paper, but my books were bound in cloth. She knew she could learn more from me. And yet, poor devil, he had the nerve to snub her when occasionally she made a simple, human, unintellectual comment. I wanted to warn him of the empty future, but instead I took another glass and said, I can't stay long, I have to go to a funeral in Golders Green. A funeral in Golders Green? Waterbury exclaimed. How like one of your own characters. It would have to be Golders Green, wouldn't it? I didn't choose the spot. Life imitating art. Is it a friend? Sylvia asked, with sympathy, and Waterbury glared at her for her irrelevance. Yes. I could see that she was speculating, man, woman, what kind of a friend, and it pleased me. For I was a human being to her, and not a writer, a man whose friends died and who attended their funerals, who felt pleasure and pain, who might even need comfort, not just a skilled craftsman whose work has greater sympathy, perhaps, than Mr. Morm's. So, of course, we cannot rank it as high as... What do you think of Forster? Waterbury asked. Forster? Oh, I'm sorry, I was just wondering how long it took to Golders Green. You ought to allow 40 minutes, Sylvia said. You have to wait for an Edgware train. Forster, Waterbury repeated irritably. You'll have to take a bus from the station, Sylvia said. Really, Sylvia, Bendrix hasn't come here to talk about how to get to Golders Green. I'm sorry, Peter, I just thought... Count six before thinking, Sylvia, Waterbury said. And now, can we get back to E.M. Forster?
Need we? I asked.
It would be interesting, as you belong to such different schools.
Does he belong to a school? I didn't even know that I did.
Are you writing a textbook?
Sylvia smiled, and he saw the smile. I knew from that moment he would grind sharp the weapon of his trade, but it didn't matter to me. Indifference and pride looked very much alike, and he probably thought I was proud. I said I really ought to be going.
But you've only been here 5 minutes. It's really important to get this article right. It's really important for me not to be late at Golders Green.
I don't see why.
Sylvia said, I'm going as far as Hampstead myself. I'll put you on your way.
You never told me, Waterbury said with suspicion.
You know I always see my mother on Wednesdays. Today's Tuesday.
Then I needn't go tomorrow.
It's very good of you, I said. I'd like your company.
You used the stream of consciousness in one of your books, Waterbury said.